This is Phil Ferrand. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today, and I think I am done for the week. Woohoo! I get to actually spend tomorrow working on my fiction, which is good because I'm in a bit of a challenge. We'll talk about that in a second. It is episode 17. I'm turning on the air conditioning because it's warm. Man, it doesn't seem possible. It's already episode 17. I got to thinking, you know, it's not going to be that long until I hit episode 26 and I will have done this for half a year, which is kind of cool. Anyways, in a little bit of a challenge right now. I can't remember if I mentioned this last week or not, but I am trying to get my second self-published novel called That Fated Shore, which is a novel, dark comedy on time travel. I'm trying to get it finished up so I can get it out to beta. And I'm in the midst of trying to figure out whether or not I can hit the moment at the end of this novel. I have been working on 8 pages of this novel for about 2 weeks now, going through iterations. And I'm actually saving all the iterations because I figure someday it might be interesting to some people to see what the iterations that a writer goes through, well, at least this writer goes through. Maybe other writers just write it the first time and it's great. But me, I go through a lot of iterations. So I've been saving them off as I've been going. It's really interesting because I thought I had it Sunday night. I put some stuff on the page, you know, read through it, started crying. I'm like, hey, there it is. Went to work Monday morning, thought, oh, I need to do this and this and this. Went home Monday night, did that, read through it. Nothing. Back to square one. So that's okay. In a little bit of a challenge. But you know what is an epic without some challenge? I mean, it really is not a quest and an epic unless there's a bit of a struggle involved. Because victory without struggle is not really that sweet. And so the creator, the architect, in his wisdom, lets us have a little struggle on some of these things. That's fine. Anyways, this past week I had finished up with a Nova program that I had actually started the week before. I have a Linksys Media Center extender in my office that I can hop over to the Media Center computer that we have in our basement, and I can pick up recorded programs, and one of the programs that we record off the air is Nova. And they have a lot of very interesting stuff. And they had put out a program, I think the first time it aired was actually in February, called Ape Genius. And they had an interesting teaser. Basically, the teaser said, the chimps are doing strange things in Africa. They're normally afraid of water, but now they are having pool parties, and they are hunting with a sharpened stick that sure looks like a spear. And I'm like, well, okay. And even more intriguing to me was the line after that. Because basically, the narrator said, for every revelation about their mind, however, another one comes that shows a stunning difference between us and the apes. And so I thought, well, that's fine. So there's going to be a lot of stuff in here about how similar we are, and I knew that. But I was intrigued to get down to, okay, what are the stunning differences? So the program started up, and in fact, they started talking about these apes, this certain tribe of chimpanzees in Africa that are doing exactly what they talked about in the teasers. Normally, chimps are afraid of water, but some of these apes have kind of gotten down into the water and held onto a vine just for safety and kind of splashed around and figured out, you know, this is kind of fun. And so some of the other ones have come in, and so they're kind of splashing around, and that's cool. That's just a learned behavior that's being passed from ape to ape. That's pretty cool. More cool than that, though, is that they are actually using sticks as spears. And there has been some observation of apes using tools before, but this is a very specific configuration. in that what the ape does is the ape goes and finds a stick and chews on the end and kind of sharpens it up a little bit and then goes looking for bush babies. These are a little mammal that apes like to eat, the chimps like to eat. And so they'll go and find what would normally be a home for a bush baby. Usually it's a hollowed out tree that's dead. And the bush baby goes down inside that for protection. And so the chimpanzee takes this stick and goes down in there and goes whack, 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 whack. With this stick and pulls it out, smells the end of it. You know, try to find out, did I make contact? And if it makes contact, then it's like whack, 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 whack. You know? And as soon as he gets done with that, he tears apart, or she tears apart, this hollowed out tree and has a little treat as bush baby. And in fact, the apes, the chimpanzees that are sort of part of this tribe, this skill has been passed from ape to ape. And the scientists are observing are saying, hey, look at that. We're going to call that culture. And we thought up to this point that only humans had culture, but we're going to call that culture. And by their definition, I don't necessarily have any problem calling it culture. Because what they said was very true. We can say and describe these apes as they have pool parties, and they use a stick like a spear, and anyone who knows would say, oh, that's one of those chimpanzees from such and such an area. There is a definable culture. Okay, fine. I got no problem with that at all. What's interesting, before we get to that though, oh, sorry, there is other examples of things that we would normally consider the purview of humans, like the understanding of language. They went through several examples of these. I won't go through all of them. But they showed this one ape, for instance, that he had about, or she had, I can't remember which, had about 3,000 English words, where the trainer could actually put a welding mask over her face and say, go outside and get the ball, and the ape would go out and get the ball, or open the refrigerator and take out such and such. And the ape could actually communicate on some level back to the researcher. And the scientists on the program were saying, well, see, look, you know, we used to think that humans were the only people that could understand language, but look, this ape understands language. So we're more similar than we thought. And certainly, you've heard the oft-quoted statistic that between chimpanzees and humans, we shared 99% of the same DNA. So the question that was proposed in the program is, what is it in that 1% that has made the difference? Because no scientist in the program was about to say that what humans have accomplished on Earth is substantially different than what chimpanzees or any of the great apes have been able to accomplish. So obviously there is something, to use their terminology, there was something that allowed humans to get off the launch pad and create all of the things that we've created. And if apes are so close to us, they were trying to research and find out what in fact was this difference. Now, one of the interesting throwaways as they're doing this research is you have this one scientist and he says something like, well, you know, the history of Western thought has been that, you know, beasts are beasts and humans are touched with the spark of God. But then, of course, the narrator goes on to say, but the more we research, you know, specific starting with Jane Goodall, and she went and she researched the apes and determined that, in fact, they have an emotional bond with their offsprings and they make tools to catch termites, all these things, that just sort of, that idea went wafting away. That humans were substantially different because they had the spark of God in them, or as I say, they had the God breath in them. But, you know, I don't ever recall making the statement that the spark of God or the breath of God in a human being is related to emotional bonds or the using of tools or even developing a culture. Now, you know, if the scientists want to say, well, that's what everybody thought, and maybe there were people who thought that, and now that we've seen these things in apes, obviously humans are just like apes. Okay, well, that's fine. You know, I'm to the point in my life where I'm still saying, you know, and I'm working on that, but I'm at the point in my life, I don't much argue with people. I listen to people's opinion, I try to evaluate it, and then I say, here's my opinion, and I give them my opinion. And if they say, no, I think you're wrong, and I say, well, I hope your worldview works out for you. Because what I've learned is that people really don't evaluate evidence and change their worldview. Under most circumstances, what they do is they take evidence and fit it into their pre-existing worldview. So since people are going to do that anyways, I really don't spend a whole lot of time trying to change people's minds. I just tell them what I think. And if I have the time, I let them come along with me and see my life and see how I relate to life. And if there's something there that's attractive to them, then maybe they'll listen to what I have to say. And if there isn't, that's okay too. You know, my philosophy is go with God. God gave you free will. Do whatever you like in life. Ta-da! Anyway, so they did have a lot of very interesting experiences. And I'll just go through some of them. And as we go along with this, if you've listened to many of these podcasts at all, I think you'll be able to at least guess what conclusions I came to after watching this. So one of the experiments that was very interesting that they did is they were trying to kind of determine the level of cooperation there was between apes, or what the motivations that apes had for their behaviors. I had a very interesting experience. You had two cages across from each other. Table is set up between these two cages. One ape is brought in, and he is trained that he can end the experiment at any time by pulling a rope because it collapses the table, and whatever food is on the table, when he pulls this rope, the table collapses, nobody can get to the food. Then they put a sliding tray onto the table and they slide it over to the first ape and they put some food in it. So he sits there, he eats the food, everything's great. But this tray has a rope on it that goes over to the other cage. They bring in another ape, the other ape is sitting there watching. It ain't no time at all that he figures out, oh, if I pull this other rope, I could get the food. So he pulls the food over to himself, and the first ape, when he sees that this other ape has stolen his food, he immediately goes over to the rope, yanks the rope. Nobody can get to the food. In other words, this ape went through the mental process of, this is my food, and if I can't have it, nobody has it. Okay, well, that's pretty interesting. He had actually kind of thought his way through that, and he actually took action based on what the circumstances were. That's pretty interesting. The other interesting experiment they set up is with some dishes. They had one ape. They brought in some dishes, and the trainer would count out M&Ms in the dishes, and then on cue, the ape would point to one of the dishes, and the dishes always had different numbers of M&Ms. So, for instance, the researcher would put six M&Ms in one dish and one in the other, and then would say, oh, so which M&M should we give to your friend? And the ape would consistently point to the one that had more M&Ms. Not because the ape wanted the friend to get more M&Ms, but because the ape could not process the fact that instead of pointing to the one with the most M&Ms, I need to point to the one with the least M&Ms because they will give that to the other ape and I can have more M&Ms. The ape could not get this. The ape would look at the bowls and go, want more, and would consistently point to the one with more, even though it meant they kept getting less. Now, what was really fascinating about this is that the research did train one of the apes to understand numerals and therefore to use symbols to determine how many M&Ms would be in the bowl. And once the researcher was able to train the apes how to use symbols, she could put a 6 in one bowl and a 3 in another bowl, and in fact, the apes could figure it out. Once they were able to abstract away from seeing the food right in front of them, they were able then to go, okay, wait a minute, if I point at the 3, I get 6, and boom, they'd get it right away. But the problem is we've never seen in the wild apes using any kind of symbology. The only way they were able to get there is by a human teaching them that symbology, and then through that symbology, they were able to use the words of the researchers to get more control over their emotions. Now that's pretty interesting. The other thing they noted about apes and language was that it was true that apes could get the structural components of the language to achieve an end. But one of the things none of these apes has ever been able to do is just engage in small talk. So, what about them cubs? You know, that type of thing. The language use by apes is always very much connected with, I want this. If I go get that for you, I get a treat. It's always very much reward-based. There doesn't seem to be, at this point, any connectivity with wanting to have a real communion or community with another person. And in fact, the claim that they made in the NOVA program was that in order to have a true conversation, you need to have a sense of what another person is thinking and be able to synchronize with it. And they were doing an experiment. Of course, when you hear the experiment, you'll know they couldn't do this with apes, but they were doing an experiment with children, which is really, really fascinating. They're doing an experiment to find out at what point children develop the ability to understand what another being is thinking. And how they'd do it is they would have this little puppet, Princess Sally, and they would have two bags. They would have a green bag, I think, and a purple bag. So then they would have the little puppet, and the puppet would come out and they'd say, oh, Princess Sally, she's going to pick up a ball and put it in the green bag. And so they'd do that. And then they'd say, now Princess Sally's going to go away, and the puppet would go under the table. And then they would say, let's move the ball. So they'd move the ball from the green bag to the purple bag. Then they would say, now Princess Sally is going to come back, and Princess Sally is going to want to find her ball. I'm just pulling on to my gravel drive. So they would bring Princess Sally back, and then they would ask children, where is Princess Sally going to look for the ball? They said 3-year-olds would be adamant about the fact that Princess Sally would go look for the ball in the purple bag, not the green one, because they knew the ball was in the purple bag, and therefore they expected Princess Sally to know the ball was in the purple bag. But they said about the time kids turn 4, they begin to abstract and to have the ability to conceptualize of what is going on in the puppet's brain, although, of course, nothing is going on in the puppet's brain, but that's okay, the kids think it is. So once the kid turns 4, the child is able to say, well, Princess Sally is going to look in the green bag because that's the last place that Princess Sally thought the ball was. And this ability to conceptualize of what another person is thinking, they think now, is one of the startling differences between our brains and ape brains. There was another very interesting experiment that they did, and I'll just tell you, I did not see this coming, and when it happened, I went, what? Are you kidding me? What they did, I'm getting my mail. One moment. what they did is they built a puzzle box. And this puzzle box had a portion on the top of it that had two plastic tubes that went through it, hard plastic, solid tubes that you could push back and forth. They weren't anchored to anything. Had a hole in the top, and then had a little flap down on the front of the box, along with other extra things. You could lift the flap, and there would be a container in there, and you could pull out a gummy bear. So what the researcher would do is the researcher would say, okay, this is how you get to the gummy bears. And so he would show the apes and the children later on, he would show and demonstrate how you get to the gummy bear. They'd go tap, 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 tap on the tubes, then use the stick to push the tubes one way, then they'd stick the stick inside the hole, tap, 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 tap on the top of the box, then they'd go down to the little flap that needed to be open and go tap, 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 tap on the flap, then they would open the flap, they would stick the stick in, and they'd fish out the gummy bear. I'm backing into my garage. So they show this to the apes. The apes get it real quick. The apes go through exactly the same set of instructions. Tap, 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 push the little bars, do all that. Finally fish out the gummy bear. So that was pretty cool. Then the next thing they did was they took the same box and they turned it into a clear acrylic box. Just a second. My wife's in the garage. Hi, sweetie. How's it going? Good. I'm not quite done with my podcast, so I'll be in just a second. Anyways, so they replaced the box. Instead of being a black box, they replaced it with a clear acrylic box. So now you can actually see. You can look inside and see what's going on. And you can see that, in fact, when you are going tap, 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 it is not doing anything. The fact that all that's really important is just sticking the stick into the little hole on the side and digging out the gummy bear. Now, what was very, very interesting is that once they brought out the acrylic box, the apes are watching the instructor and they go, okay, forget this nonsense. We're going for the gummy bear. And they immediately just flip open the thing and dig out the gummy bear. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, kids are that smart. They'll do that. In fact, the children mimic what the teacher shows them to do. They still do the tap, 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 pushy, 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 boom, 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 click, click, boom. It's not that the children couldn't figure out that it was only the last action that brought the true reward. What they were saying is that children are wired for learning. And they are willing to learn from others, whether it makes sense to them or not. They expect to be taught. And one of the ways they were saying that this expectation to be taught shows up very early on, even before language, is with what they called the deceptively simple gesture of pointing. The children point at stuff. When they want to know what it is, point. And parents point at stuff. And I'm already in my garage, so I'll just skip the whole pointing experiments and things that they did because they were actually really cool. Apparently, apes cannot get pointing. They would put like a treat underneath two cups without the ape seeing it. And then they would point at one cup and the ape was like, knocks both cups down looking for the treat. Whereas kids, they immediately get the whole pointing thing. But they were saying there was another aspect of pointing as well, that pointing allows one human to focus another human's attention. And so when we point, another human looks at what we're pointing at, and suddenly they called it the triangle, where you have two humans, and then you have the object of the attention. And that kind of synchronicity does not happen in apes. And they had some interesting experiments in terms of cooperation, that kind of stuff. That synchronicity does not happen. But what they were saying is that humans have this ability to synchronize themselves with each other. The other thing they noted that is fundamentally different in humans is that not only are humans willing to learn from other humans, humans are also willing to teach. And so, what that does from a cultural standpoint is you don't have geniuses who are sitting over in the corner figuring out, I can make a sharpened stick. I'll get me some food with this. And having to have other people looking over and going, what's that guy doing over there? What do you do with that stick? And learning that way. But in fact, the genius comes back into the culture and says, hey, I have a sharpened stick. It's pretty cool. This is how you make it. And can communicate that knowledge through teaching because humans enjoy being the teacher and humans enjoy learning. And so that knowledge can be very quickly pushed throughout the entire tribe when something works. And this allows us actually to capitalize on those rare individuals that come through our society that figure out how to do something better. Because that knowledge can be disseminated very, very quickly, and everybody gets the improvement. Okay, so, I'm watching this whole program, and I'm thinking, yeah, right? Because let's just quickly go back to the whole idea of the spark of God or the breath of God. That what differentiates humans from the rest of the animals on this wonderful world that God has made is that He has breathed into us the breath of life. And one of the components of that breath is spirit. And when you look at apes and you look at humans, the behavior that we're getting out of apes, I would say, is flesh-driven. Apes are very aware of when my rights are being trampled on. You're taking my food, I'm ending the experiment. Boom! They're very aware of there's more in that bowl, I want it. Even though whatever I point to is going to another ape. They still can't. I want more. Oh, it goes to him. Wait, I want more. They can't get past that. You try to teach them something, they look at it and go, well, forget that. I just want the gummy bear. They go straight to it. There's nothing that constrains the ape to say, okay, I really don't get this whole thing, but this person probably knows more than I do, so I'll just go ahead and learn it and see how it works out. Now, obviously, we have a lot of things in our lives as human where the flesh does reign and the flesh does slow us down. But I think all we have to do is look across the world and we can see amazing examples of the breath of God in us. We've talked about this in terms of creativity, in terms of inventiveness, in terms of our willingness to learn. I would add to this list as well, having watched this episode. What I found interesting, just to wrap this up, is at the very top of this episode, simply because they had found some apes with emotions and with cultures and they were using sticks, is they got in their little thing where they kind of poo-pooed this whole idea of the spark of God in humans. And yet, by the time the episode got all the way to the bottom, I was very easily able to take all the things that they were describing as being unique to humans and saying, you know what? Sounds like spirit to me. And when it comes down to it, spirit is really all about that breath of God within us. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home. Have a great day.